Money Radio. Thank you for joining us. Pleasure now to welcome Antonio Garcia Martinez. He has done a lot in Silicon Valley, one of the high-tech folks, an advisor to Twitter, a product manager for Facebook, CEO and founder of AdGrok, a venture-backed startup that was eventually acquired by Twitter. He is also a writer. New book, Chaos Monkeys. And no, this has nothing to do with a National Geographic expedition into the jungles. Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune and Random Failure in Silicon Valley by Antonio Garcia Martinez. Chaos Monkeys. Antonio, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Chaos Monkeys, a little bit redundant, isn't it?
Well, so there's actually an origin behind that title. Chaos Monkeys actually refers to a piece of software, and the way to understand it is, imagine a wild, crazy monkey running through a data center, the sort of large air-conditioned rooms where all the machines that run the internet live, and imagine the monkey running through, pulling on cables, kicking over boxes. There's actually a piece of software that Netflix created that actually does that as a way to test their infrastructure. So if they need to test if they can stream House of Cards, for example, they'll run the Chaos Monkeys to attack their machines and see if you can still stream Chaos Monkeys. And so that's actually like a software tool. And then metaphorically, what I meant by that was that Silicon Valley today, if you want to understand kind of the role that I think it plays in society, is that it's sort of society's Chaos Monkeys. It'll go and pull the plug on taxis by launching an app called Uber, in which anybody can become a taxi driver, and suddenly having a taxi medallion isn't the sort of long-term investment it used to be. Or they'll launch Airbnb, and suddenly anybody with a spare bedroom or a weekend cabin can suddenly become an innkeeper, and so much for your hotel, right? And so Silicon Valley is kind of this chaos monkey rampaging through society, just pulling the plug on things, and we as a society have to see if we're robust to these disruptions. So that's where that title comes from.
And really, for most people looking at Silicon Valley and what goes on there, it does appear to be pure chaos.
No, and they're right to think that. It kind of is. One of the lessons, I think, from the book, the sort of inside peek, is that even inside companies like Facebook, and I was there relatively late, from 2011, 2013, a year before and a year after the IPO, right? So we're talking a company either on the cusp of becoming public or, in fact, a public company worth billions of dollars. And, you know, chaos might be a little bit maybe too extreme, but it was very improvisational, impromptu, and everyone was trying to sort of figure it out as they went along. As an outsider, you sort of imagine, Zuckerberg and Sheryl sitting in some bunker surrounded by their lieutenants and coming up with some bold vision over the next 5 or 10 years. And the reality is it's not really like that at all. In the prologue to the book, actually, I detail the meeting where Zuckerberg actually approved joining Outside Data to Facebook, to its actual user experience, which is a product that I worked on and built and pitched. And, it was a 10-minute thing. The full repercussions weren't even understood at the time, but we went ahead with it. And, you know, today, if you go browse the internet or even buy things in stores, you might see those same products inside your Facebook experience. And that was directly due to that 10-minute meeting that I describe in the first chapter of the book.
But that 10-minute meeting really didn't decide things. It was another year till they decided to decide.
Yes, you're a keen reader of the book. Yeah, no, that's right. So we decided to sort of open the gates, but the bigger strategic question of, and I don't want to bog down with too much, tech discussion here, but there's basically two ways to do a lot of this data joining that your listeners might be noticing in Facebook. And, you know, it became kind of a meta question of what sort of ad system do you want to build? What's Facebook's role in this ads ecosystem, et cetera. And you're right, it took about a year for the company to finally decide which way it was going. And it was weird. It was this complete lack of decisiveness, mostly due to management failing that they later fixed. But again, for 1 year, Facebook was sort of flailing and trying to figure it out until it finally did.
I want to get back to internet ads, but first of all, how you need to explain how you got involved in this, because you didn't start out in Silicon Valley. You started out in, of all places, Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, I know. So one of the interesting things, and part of the reason why I included the Goldman chapter in there, it wasn't just the sort of preface. One of the interesting things that's going on just globally with technology, like one of these, 20, 30, year-long things that we can think about, is that in Wall Street, I caught sort of the tail end of a historical process that was very interesting, and that was, you know, the traditional financial exchanges, the guys in colored jackets at, you know, at the New York Stock Exchange or the Chicago Merc or whatever, all those guys got replaced by super fast computers talking to each other. So, you know, I was at CNBC doing an interview, and there's basically nothing going on at the exchange anymore. It literally is just a backdrop for CNBC. It doesn't do anything. Mm-hmm. All the trade volume actually goes through machines. And that same process of going from, you know, humans and steak dinners and faxes and phone calls to machines talking to each other in microseconds or milliseconds, that same transformation was happening in media, like around, well, even still now, but it started about 2008. And so that shift from Wall Street, when Wall Street blew up in 2008, to media in 2008 actually wasn't really as big a leap as you might think due to these changes going on in media at the time.
We are seeing a shift, and it's been described as a shift from either you are telling the computers what to do or the computers will tell you what to do.
Yeah, no, I quote a famous VC, Marc Andreessen, one of the early founders of Netscape, and the full quote is, or I'm paraphrasing, but in the future there'll be two types of jobs. You either tell the computer what to do, or the computer tells you what to do, right? And obviously it's a simplification, but I think there's a lot of insight there, and it's absolutely the case that will be the case looking forward. I mean, if you look at San Francisco in microcosm, the reason why this city is kind of interesting and kind of horrifying in a way is that it kind of does live in the future. I mean, living in San Francisco now is like what the rest of the U.S. will be in 5 years. And what's happening? Well, you have the people who tell the computers what to do, you know, people like me and my former job or my colleagues now, and they get paid very well. They have a very cushy life. They have shuttles that take them to work. They have free food. They live inside this corporate campus, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have companies like Uber or a company called Instacart, for example, that's personalized shopping, in which they basically use humans as part of a mobile app, right? You know, they use humans for the few things that the computer can't do until now, which is shop for a car or pick out a packet of food on the shelf at Whole Foods, right? And that's the weird thing about it. Automation is gone. Think about, you know, a century ago, what was automation? Automation was a piece of technology doing something that humans couldn't do, and it was one small part of a human workflow, right? The cashier's register or the accountant's adding machine or whatever, right? But now it's the opposite, right? Humans are the little stopgap in basically an automated computer workflow, right? The last little step is actually driving the car that Uber dispatched, and so they have a human there. And as soon as they can replace that human with a machine, they will, right? And it's the same thing with a lot of the quote-unquote jobs or sort of gig economy-type jobs that Silicon Valley is producing. It's producing this future in which, yeah, you either tell the computer what to do or it tells you, and that in some ways is the future. That's right.
The humans, though, are still consumers as well. And as such,
right,
they are the target of so much of what takes place in Silicon Valley. I mean, so much of what Silicon Valley is about is just a big sales job, isn't it?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, there's this famous scene in which it's apocryphal, obviously, I think in the 50s, when you know, GM was having some labor strife, and or maybe it was the 60s, they were using their first automated machines to replace workers on the assembly line, and supposedly the CEO of GM was walking with the labor union leader, and the CEO of GM said, aha, look at these computers, look at these machines we put in, they can't go on strike. And the labor union leader responded, yeah, well, but then who's going to buy your cars, right? A computer robot doesn't need a car, right? And that's kind of the problem, you're right. I mean, these companies still need consumers with jobs and disposable income to actually run. So, yeah, you're right. The humans are still part of society. They can't be banished. And not everyone can get a job as an engineer at Facebook or Google. I think it's, we're headed to some real economic strife in the future, just to look out, you know, 20, 30 years.
You seem uniquely qualified because of your background at Facebook as well as Ad Grok to explain how internet ads work.
Right. So, that's a long story. But so here's how it works, or here's how I created
Facebook. Because they seem to be following me wherever I go.
Right. You and your listeners might be familiar with the book Flash Boys by Michael Lewis, how he describes this process that I alluded to earlier about exchanges being replaced by machines.
Mm-hmm.
Well, believe it or not, there's a similar Flash Boys process for media. Every time you go to Facebook or that you go to almost any site on the internet, believe it or not, literally every page you load, there are signals, requests going out to advertisers and their agents saying, this user, it's all anonymized, of course, not your name, but they're basically saying, this user showed up. Are you, do you have anything of, you know, do you want to show him anything? And then those advertisers then look at their databases in which they've recorded, you know, everything you've bought, often including their physical stores or online. They come up with a bid for you. They come up with a piece of ad creative based on what you've bought in the past, and they respond immediately. And that happens in literally 120 milliseconds, hundreds of billions of times a day, right? This is how the real-time ads, you know, programmatic media world actually works. And that's what I built at Facebook. I was the guy who pitched and led the team that built FBX, which is Facebook Exchange, which is Facebook's version of this. And of course, there's a more proprietary Facebook version of it. But at the end of the day, that sort of real-time element of you leave a data trail and then it gets ingested by advertisers and publishers in literally instantaneously. That's how it works, and it's all based on ultra-fast fiber optic cables and machines talking to each other in the same way that, you know, millions of Google shares change hands every day now on the exchange. Billions of eyeballs basically change hands, or at least are rented, you know, billions of times a day right now. That's literally how it works.
So then that raises the next question, who is Big Brother?
No, that's great. And I actually address this in the book. And it's funny, I'll come off as a defender of Facebook, and obviously I'm somewhat biased because I did work there. You know, it's not really Facebook that's the big brother, because the advertisers themselves don't want Facebook to sort of ingest all the data because they don't sort of ultimately trust Facebook. The companies that I highlight actually as the big brothers in the book are companies that you've probably never heard of, or most of you probably haven't heard of. Companies with the names like Experian, Axiom, Neustar, et cetera. And these are companies that actually originally came out of the direct mail world. So believe it or not, the really good, accurate, you know, scientific, rational ads targeting actually came out of the direct mail world, like in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And these are the people that figure out that, you know, you've just had a child and you start getting, I don't know, diaper catalogs in the mail, even though you don't ever remember having signed up for diaper anything, right? And so they've been doing this for decades. And the challenge they face now is that since most of the media we consume and much of commerce is online, is taking all that data and bringing it online in various ways. But of course, they don't actually own the online space. They don't own publishers. They don't own Facebook. And so they have to sort of meet in the middle and work with Facebook to get that data online. And I describe a lot of how that happens in the book. And so if you want to, you know, short answer to your question, who is the big brother? I think these days it is companies like the ones I just mentioned that aggregate a lot of this data and have been doing it for decades. I mean, by the way, your listeners, whether you realize it or not, I mean, forget Facebook. Companies like Axiom know where you live, how many people are in that house, what your income level is, what your consumption pattern is, your education, everything that would actually predict your consumption pattern. They know all of that, actually. And it's completely legal for them in the U.S. for them to know that and use that. And it's almost impossible to actually, you know, figure out what they know about you. And it's very difficult to opt out. And so those are really the big brothers. Facebook, at the end of the day, and I know it'll sound a little bit cheerleader, cares about you, the user, and wants to keep you engaged with Facebook. At the end of the day, they really don't care about money that much. They really don't care about the advertiser. But it's the advertiser and then the data aggregators that work for the advertisers. Those are the ones that will stop at nothing to sell you a sweater or a pair of shoes. And really, those are the people that, if you want to be freaked out about somebody, that's who you should be freaked out about.
Should we be freaked out?
No, because I think it's just commerce. I mean, look, at the end of the day, they're just trying to sell you a pair of shoes, right? Like, who cares? You know, in Europe, for example, Europe treats this, just to go a little international, treats it very differently. In the U.S., it's seen as a consumer choice issue. Like, you know, I can choose to opt out of a catalog, whatever. In Europe, it really is seen as like a human rights issue. Obviously, they've had a tortured political history, particularly in countries like Germany, and they see that level of tracking, and they think, oh, my God, what if it gets into the wrong hands? And then for whatever reason in the U.S., we don't have that paranoia because we haven't had that history of you know, totalitarianism that Europe has had. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think I'm more on the American side of the spectrum. I mean, sure, I don't know. Yeah, if the U.S. government somehow took over and requisitioned a lot of this consumer data, could they use it in some nefarious way? I mean, possibly. But, I mean, look what the NSA is doing, right? I mean,
but for now, they just want to sell you some shoes.
Exactly. They just want to sell you some shoes, yeah.
Hang on just a moment. Yeah. We're talking with Antonio Garcia Martinez, author of the new book, Chaos Monkeys. This is a good one for summer reading. You're going to like it. Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune and Random Failure in Silicon Valley. And we'll have more with Antonio Garcia Martinez on Chaos Monkeys in just a moment. Money Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. Our guest today, Antonio Garcia Martinez, the book Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune and Random Failure in Silicon Valley, Chaos Monkeys. You had that unique background, initially starting out of school, working with Goldman Sachs for a while, and you also have done a startup and sold it. Let's talk about the role of venture capitalism in Silicon Valley. This is really the lifeblood of what makes Silicon Valley work, isn't it?
Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's venture capital, in case, you know, listeners don't know. It's basically you get a pile of money from either a rich guy in the early stages called an angel, or increasingly people who actually have a fund. They've raised money from third parties, either other wealthy individuals or pension funds, the usual asset management sort of class of people who want their money invested. And then they write you checks, and those checks get bigger and bigger in time as you have various funding series, and they take more and more of the company. You're basically trading equity in a company that has more potential than actual value. And then they give you cash, and then armed with ideas and people and execution, you go and try to create something that's worth way, way, way more than what it started being worth. And that's literally how that's the literally the drum to which all of Silicon Valley marches. How I think it's changed, and I detail this in the book, is that back in the day, go back 10, 15 years or more, 20, 25, when companies like Oracle and Apple were starting, the funding landscape was very different, right? I mean, you needed a lot of money to start a company, right? Because you literally had to own machines that you plugged in. You needed, like, proper phones. Like, everything was just more expensive, right? Now the marginal cost of technology is actually quite a bit lower. Not only that, given the several waves of wealth that we've had in Silicon Valley from the initial stages of, you know, Microsoft and Apple and whatever until now, the genius of Silicon Valley, you know, what the magic thing that every economy in the world tries to reproduce but fails is that those who made money in, like, boom number one will then reinvest it and create boom number two, which will produce more wealthy people that will produce boom number three, and on it goes. And we've reached to a point of such accumulation of wealth that these angels, these people that, you know, back in the day could write you like a $20,000 check, or, you know, you would go and ask your dad for some money and he'd write you a $10,000 check and you'd get started that way, forget it. The initial money in, the investors that invested in AgRock, they'll write you a $200,000 check. And a lot of it's because it's not even their personal wealth. They've raised a small fund, a $10 or $20 million fund from wealthy people they know, and they can write those checks. And so even a company like mine that wasn't even that successful, and we had, you know, it was very early stage when we raised money, we were actually getting sued, so we had, like, litigation risk, we could still go out there and in almost no time at all raise $500,000 without even trying that hard. And so that's the reality of venture capital today in Silicon Valley, and that's what's really driving a lot of the bubble that you see.
You used an interesting line as you were speaking there. You said the genius of Silicon Valley. Is Silicon Valley really living up to its potential, or is it just selling shoes?
You know, that's a good question. There's a famous quote by Peter Thiel, who was an early Facebook investor, that, you know, we were promised flying cars, and we got 140 characters, referring to Twitter, which has a 140 character limit. Like, in other words, we're supposed to have this spectacular Jetsons-like technology, and all we're doing is taking selfies, right? And so, I agree that there's a real criticism there that, like, I mean, come on, like, we're spending all this money, and is it really benefiting society in a deep way? I mean, I think there are some companies, and they may not get a lot of the PR and the buzz, frankly, that are doing exciting things, right? I mean, obviously, one that gets a lot of buzz is Elon Musk's SpaceX, right? I think that actually, you know, privately funded successful space exploration with reusable rockets, that actually is completely epoch-changing. Like, you know, that will change the game. You know, Tesla, to a certain degree, the next phase of transportation is very important. There's people in microsatellites. There's people in doing lots of, you know, health and disease detection. There are a lot of things going on, but unfortunately, a lot of it gets drowned out with the Snapchats of the world. So, it's unfortunate. I think the criticism is a fair one, but I think if you dig a little bit deeper, you do see that Silicon Valley actually is fomenting real innovation.
I got to say, it's an intriguing book, taking a look at what is going on in Silicon Valley. Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune and Random Failure in Silicon Valley. Chaos Monkeys by Antonio Garcia Martinez. And if you do wonder what is going on in Silicon Valley and what is changing in the world of tech, you'll enjoy this book, Chaos Monkeys, Antonio Garcia Martinez. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.